This lecture is about cross-country differences in living standards, or cross-country differences in economic growth. In 1800, the average world GDP per capita was only about $250 per year. That is, each person had about $250 worth of goods and services to live on, in what would be considered today's terms, $250. That's very little. It's barely above subsistence, really. Subsistence might be, let's say, $150 per year. And so, if you read, Charles Dickens' description of London in the 1800s, and you see poverty and squalor for people, that's an accurate description of the way the world was 200 years ago. Mostly very, very poor by today's standards. If you think about the poverty line in the United States, it's about $14,000 for a family of four, or about $3,500 per person. So we consider someone to be below the poverty line if the average income per person in a household is $3,500 per year or less. And the entire average was 250, 200 years ago. So you can see just how incredibly poor people were 200 years ago compared today. So even today, there are poor countries in Africa where GDP per capita averages less than $500 per year. On the other hand, the United States, Canada, Japan, many other nations of Western Europe have averaged GDP per capita today of over $20,000. So a lot of divergence. 200 years ago, there wasn't much room for differences in average GDP per capita across countries because no country had really, high GDP per capita by today's standards. They all had very miserably low GDP per capita by today's standards 200 years ago. But since that time, some countries have really taken off, and while African countries are today way above the average of the world 200 years ago, they're not nearly as high in terms of per capita GDP as US, Canada, and Japan. So here's some cross-country data as of 1998. If you look at this table, the United States, $27,000 per capita, and then some Western countries, Denmark, Switzerland, Japan, so on. You get down to Mexico, $7,000 per capita. Other Latin American countries average 6,000. Former Soviet Union only 4,000. China 3,000. India 2,000. Africa 1,000. Brad DeLong has written a macroeconomics textbook that has a long chapter on economic growth. Makes the following remarks about GDP in different groups. First of all, in 1950, the gap between the US and Japan and Western Europe was wider than it is today. So Japan and Western Europe have closed some of the gap. Japan, for example, in 1950 had a GDP per capita only 20% of the US level, just one-fifth of the level. And of all the other countries, only Britain's was over 50% of the US level. But now most of these countries are over 70% of the US level. Another thing to notice is that communists had enormous impact, an enormous adverse impact on relative GDP. Brad picks out, sort of non-communist and communist countries that are right near each other. For example, North Korea and South Korea are obviously right near each other. And North Korea's GDP per capita in 1997 was only $700, but South Korea's was 13,600. So here's essentially the same land, the same people, but different system of government, and makes a huge difference in per capita GDP. Comparing Russia and Finland, again, two countries that live that are near each other, but with different systems of government. Finland, a GDP of 20,000 versus 4,400 for Russia. Another example that Brad gives is Cuba and Mexico, again, two countries near each other. Cuba's per capita GDP only 3,100, Mexico's 8,400. So another comment that DeLonge makes is that in spite of convergence within the OECD, overall, and the OECD means the Western countries like Japan and Western Europe and the United States, in spite of the convergence there, overall economic performance has diverged. He says that there's been enormous divergence in relative output per worker levels over the past 100 years. Since 1870, the ratio of richest to poorest economies has increased sixfold. In 1870, two-thirds of all countries had GDP per capita between 60 and 160% of the average. Today, that range that includes two-thirds of all countries extends from 35 to 280% of the average. So that's sort of a measure of how dispersed the standard of living has become. The gaps in the standard of living between the richer countries and the poorer countries have widened over the past 100 years. Now you might think that this divergence is what you'd expect, as the old line, the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. But in fact, economics suggests that it should not be the case that on a country-by-country basis the rich should get richer and the poor should get poorer. That is, you would not expect poor countries to stay poor forever. And here are some of the reasons for that. One is labor mobility. That is, people who live in poor countries will want to move to rich countries in order to take advantage of higher wages. So the result of that should be to increase the supply of labor in rich countries, bringing down average income there. It should reduce the supply of labor in poor countries, and with less excess labor, the average incomes of workers should rise in those countries. So what you would think with labor mobility, you would tend to see less divergence in the standard of living. Another thing that would affect relative standard of living in countries is capital mobility. That is, if you're a business, like let's say you're General Motors, and you're looking for the least expensive place to locate a plant to produce an automobile, well, if workers are paid much more in the United States than in, let's say, Brazil, you would want to locate a plant in Brazil in order to take advantage of the, lower rental costs, lower labor costs, and so on. And as you do that, as you start to relocate more plants overseas, that should increase the incomes of workers in other countries. So that's another thing that should cause convergence, is capital mobility. And finally, there's information mobility. If you believe that, as economists have come to believe, that information and know-how are the keys to economic success, well, in principle, there's nothing stopping information and knowledge from moving across countries. So other countries should know how to achieve our high level of productivity simply by watching how our businesses operate and what production techniques we use and so on. In a recipe economy, most of the recipes are known out there, and you would think that just by copying our recipes, other countries would have higher productivity. All the key elements in economic growth are mobile, and you would think that because of that, there should be convergence in economic growth. The one thing that's not mobile is natural resources. But natural resources seems to be the one factor that doesn't make a huge difference in countries' wealth. That is, we have countries with a lot of natural resources, like oil resources, that perform poorly, and we have countries like Japan, which have very poor natural resources and yet perform quite well. So, a summary of some of the things that we find are that in different countries, we see a very strong, very large gap between communist and non-communist countries, which suggests that the method of government and the type of economic system you run makes a huge difference for per capita GDP for the standard of living as measured that way. Another thing that we've observed is Europe and Asia converging with the US, which suggests that countries that have somewhat similar economic systems to the United States, we do see the effects of labor mobility, capital mobility, information mobility, is that they have been able to gain on the United States relative to the United States in their standard of living. A third thing to observe is the English-speaking world took a leap ahead over the last 10 to 15 years. So the United States, Ireland, Australia, England, all grew somewhat faster than other countries. And there's a number of possible reasons for that. One may be that the computer revolution has benefited English speakers, in part because a lot of the know-how about computers is embedded in English. There are, English books about, how to do computer programming, how to build computers and so on, how to take advantage of them. And another factor may be the internet, which is mostly most websites and so on are English speaking, and that has enabled trade to open up among in the English-speaking parts of the world. So, Ireland was one of the first countries to be involved in the outsourcing of services, so that things like call centers in the United States would go to Ireland, or we would ship computer programming jobs to Ireland. And then finally, the English-speaking world has tended to be a little bit more freely capitalistic, a little less regulation, a little less of welfare states, and that may have facilitated somewhat faster growth. Another development we've seen recently is that India and China have surged. The data that are in this table above for India and China are probably somewhat out of date. China has grown at about almost a 10% per year pace, and India more than 5% per year for the last several years. And again, there are questions about what caused that, but most people would suggest that they've loosened the regulations on their economies, allowed them their economies to operate with more freedom, and that's made a difference. Both of them, especially India, may have benefited from this general surge in the English-speaking world, because many people in India, at least in the upper classes there, have learned they learn English routinely, and that has enabled them to participate in the general strong performance of the English-speaking world over the past 10, 15 years. Another phenomenon that we've observed historically is a lot of instability in Latin America. Argentina, prior to World War I, was basically at the near the bottom end of the Western of the high GDP economies. That is, they were very close to being as high in terms of standard of living as Western European countries. But the instability of Argentina has caused it to really slip back to being, closer to an underdeveloped country. And in general, Latin American countries have not been able to break into the higher end of the developed world. Africa and the Arab world have been stuck at the lower end of standard of living for quite a while. So that raises questions about, what causes prosperity. And I have one of the chapters in the book that you read for this discusses sort of my views on what causes prosperity. And I've probably mentioned some of those before, but it's a very interesting topic, and it's something that a lot of economists have spent a lot of time trying to think about and try to understand better. And there's certainly no consensus on what sort of economic policies, if any economic policies, can raise the standard of living of an underdeveloped country. One general rule of thumb is that sort of 20% of the differences in labor productivity can be attributed to just the amount of capital in the countries. Like the United States has so much more plant and equipment that that automatically would raise our labor productivity by, 20% relative to a country that has a lot less. But there's a lot of un but capital doesn't explain everything, and there's this sort of 80% that is explained by other factors, and just basically better use of knowledge and freer trade, or we don't exactly know what accounts for all the other differences in standard of living that cannot be explained by capital. But the important things to remember are that there is this huge divergence in standard of living and GDP per capita across countries and across regions, that if you look at the at neighboring communist and non-communist countries, it's clear that the economic and political system makes a very big difference in the standard of living. So we know that much. Beyond that, among countries that are nominally non-communist, it's a lot harder to pick out the exact reasons for differences in standard of living. One of the things that I recommend, and it's on the a potential, it's a book that's on the list for the book project, if you want to look at it, is Robert Kaplan's Eastward to Tartary, where he takes a ground level view of some of the very poorly performing economies, poorly performing countries in the former Soviet Union. And you can see there this the phenomenon of policemen arresting you for no grounds and demanding a bribe so that you don't end up put in jail. And you can imagine how difficult it would be to start undertake economic activity in countries where crime syndicates, often in cooperation with the police, will steal anything that you produce. And that so you can see that the quality of governance has to matter a lot in producing a high standard of living. But in general, I have to reiterate, economists do not have a magic formula for bringing an underdeveloped country up to Western living standards.